You're listening to the Growing Leaders Podcast, episode number 22. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. Today, we've got Dr. Tim Elmore in the studio. We also have Stephen Mansfield calling in with us today. Stephen is an author of over 17 books, three of which are New York Times bestsellers, and his most recent book is called Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. Now, Stephen also works at the Mansfield Group, which does leadership consulting as far as communication, content, and then also leadership development within each person's role as well. So Tim's going to interview Stephen today. So Tim, why don't you take it from here?
Thanks, Jim. Stephen, we're very, very grateful for you to spend some time with us, carve out that time. I know you're a busy man. I'd love to just jump right in. You have written on leadership, but in every case, you've tended to write books about your passion, or at least a passion in that season of your life. Talk about some of the books you've written and why you wrote them.
You know, my interest is how leadership is fashioned, what shapes it, what makes it work, what fuels it. And certainly one of the things I've explored is faith. I'm convinced that, as I've said in a couple of my books, that if a man's or a woman's faith is sincere, then it's the most important thing about them.
Yeah.
And therefore it's going to shape their leadership. And you won't be able to predict what they're going to do in office or understand what they're doing in office without understanding their unique brand of faith. So that's why I wrote the faith of George W. Bush and the faith of Barack Obama. I wrote about Pope and even Churchill from the standpoint of faith, because I think it's a key to understanding them, and so I wanted to affect our nation in that direction. And then also, I wanted to give a new generation on the rise some of the keys of great leadership, and of course, faith being one of those building blocks.
Absolutely.
So that's why I've written most of the books that I've written. And then just recently, it's just time for all the men in our nation to man up. And so I've written Mansfield's Book of Manly Men. We're having a lot of fun with it, but also it's a serious charge to men to be great men, as I call them.
Absolutely. You know, your book on Winston Churchill is, you know, he's a hero of mine. It's my favorite book on Winston Churchill of all the books I've read.
Really?
I mean that sincerely. This is not just talk on the podcast here. Just absolutely devoured it, highlighted every page, have passed it around, requested people to get it. So I just wanted you to know, I think it was so well written, and it just so encapsulates the soul of Winston Churchill so well.
I appreciate you saying that, but as much as your words touch me, you just said some very bad words to me. You passed the book around.
instead of selling it.
Mine, you make people buy them. That's
right. You remind me of Andy Stanley. He said, you don't have to read my book, just buy it. That's right.
Absolutely. Just remember these words, libraries and sharing are of the devil.
That's right.
That's all I have to say.
Okay. I'll remember that.
Not really.
Here's a question I wanted to ask you. Because you often focus on leaders and their leadership style and their faith, based on your research, who are some of the leaders through history that you most admire?
Well, I admire Winston Churchill perhaps as much as any other man except Jesus. The things he had to overcome. See, people mainly know of Winston Churchill, you know, the humorous statements and the great speeches and the jaunty cigar and the bowler hat. All those symbols, but he had horrible dark nights of the soul to overcome.
Yeah.
He had a father who hated him. He failed often throughout his life. He had a troubled marriage and kids who, one child even committed suicide, et cetera. But he overcame those, and the inspiration he found in those dark nights of the soul is what he offered to the world at really critical times. So I think he would be number one. Teddy Roosevelt would be another. I'm very inspired by Nelson Mandela, Booker T. Washington. I could just go on and on because I read so much history and I'm inspired by it. I have lots of heroes, but these are the people that I think have great lessons to teach us.
Yeah, that's great. You said earlier that if faith is central to a leader, it should be the most important part of their leadership. Talk about the role of faith. And we have people listening in that are not just Jesus followers. They're all kinds, all walks, but they're people of faith. But I agree with you. If faith is anything at all, it informs our leadership, doesn't it? I mean, it has
to. Absolutely does. If a man or a woman's faith is sincere, like I say, it's going to be that their faith is going to frame their worldview. It's going to frame their ethical system. When you think about what elected leaders do, they mainly deal with issues of law. And law is what? Law is the codification of a value system. Law is somebody putting into a legal code what's right and wrong in their view. Well, religion frames all of that. So when a person's faith is sincere and fiery in their soul, it's what's going to get them through the night. It's what's going to keep them from misbehaving, keep them on an ethical track. It's what's going to frame their ethical and moral decisions, not just personally, but in terms of what they codify in the law. It's going to frame, for example, their understanding of fair play. And if, for example, a person of a different faith might have responded differently from President Obama in the whole Crimean issue of late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to work through Congress and what have you. But the fact is that your religious faith shapes and frames, maybe the best way to say it is, it's the lens through which you view the world. Therefore, your leadership that's based on your view of the world is going to be faith-defined. And
yeah.
Doesn't mean that, you know, you spend all your days in the Oval Office if you're president, you're just, you know, praying and studying the Bible. But it does mean that every decision you make is framed in some way by the lens of faith that that pervades your entire life.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I'd like you to talk now, and I want us to drill down on this even a little bit longer here. So take your time on this if you want. Explain your passion for developing healthy leadership qualities in the next generation. You referred earlier, you made a comment about how you do have a heart for a new batch of young leaders to get this thing right. Because really, in many ways, us boomers, there were a lot of flaws. And now we're in midlife and beyond, and we see that, my goodness, we're having a hard time balancing a budget, keeping a marriage together, etc. Talk about your heart for the next generation and why it's so absolutely important for us to intentionally develop leadership in them.
Well, it's one of my views of history that if the generation that's in the lead at any given time does not actively attend to the younger generation, that generation will be ignored, unfinanced, not taught. There's a theory that the generation that's paying the bills, whether it's in a church or in the society as a whole, gets most of the benefits.
Yeah.
Well, the young can't pay the bills yet, so to speak, societally speaking. So they are often, you know, sidelined. In our time, it's particularly important that the older ones pour into the next generation because there's so much coming against them.
Yeah.
The difficult economies that we've handed them, the nastiness of media that teaches them things that are the opposite of what's best for them and healthy lives, healthy marriages, great kids. The fact that they need help. Many of us, I don't know what your story is in going to college, even though we went to the same one, but I know in my case, I wasn't helped by my parents to go to college, so I had to fight through the whole thing myself, pay for it all.
Yeah.
That's okay in my case. It probably built some muscles, you know, intellectually and spiritually speaking, that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But for the most part, we need to be turning and helping those who are rising. I think that's part of the godly responsibility on every generation. So I'm deeply moved by the young on the rise. I think some of our greatest leaders are in what we're now calling the millennials.
If
you read all the literature, many people the experts supposedly are telling business community to be afraid of the millennials. I feel completely differently. I think they're going to be really great. They got to overcome some selfishness and some of the things that we've done to them, but I think phenomenal leaders are in that generation. But they are going to need older brothers, fathers, mentors, and I intend to be one of them. And I think we'll see some great things arise from that age.
Absolutely, I totally agree. In fact, we often say when we're in front of faculty, coaches, teachers, parents, we believe they could be the greatest generation America's ever seen. But then I always add the caveat, and you just said it: they will be if we rethink how we're leading them and preparing them.
Absolutely.
If we'll do that, they're a huge generation. In fact, if we're serious about impacting the world, we got to get serious about understanding this emerging generation. So I take your words to heart. I think they're spot on.
If I can just jump in real quick, I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but I just want to say that, you know, people who are in the public eye don't often talk the way I'm about to talk. But when I was 18, I mean, I'm shocked I ever got into a university. I was probably ADD.
Yeah.
I was violent. I was an angry jock. I was high school All-American and had other awards as a football player. But, angry at my father, angry at having to live all over the world with the military, angry at the criticism I got at home, probably had some intellectual dysfunction that would have been diagnosed today, I think, more specifically. If I had not had older brothers, if I had not had mentors, if I had not had professors just kind of look at me with the kind face that said, "You're an idiot, but you're my idiot, and I'm going to help you," I would never have gotten to where I am, which is, you know, not where I hope to be one day, but it's further along. Absolutely. And so I just want to say real quick, you know, that sometimes guys who are, you know, interviewed on radio shows and write New York Times bestselling books don't take a moment to drop back and say, oh my gosh, I looked worse than you do I was 18, when I was 17, when I was 16. And trust me, I may have a little notoriety now, but that only came because some people did for me exactly what I'm saying we need to do for the millennials.
That's great. Well said. And that's really what we're all about. So I think that segues really into one of the chief topics I want to wrestle with today, and that's your newest book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men. I love that title. And then the subtitle, An Utterly Invigorating Guide to Being Your Most Masculine Self. First of all, unpack that, because perhaps someone that might be might consider herself a feminist would go, what in the world are you talking about? So would you kind of describe
that? I'm obviously having some fun with this book, we use fun graphics and everything. I even joke around, tell guys to sleep on it, and their testosterone level will rise. Of course, I'm just joking. but what I'm doing is, there are two things that led me into this book, and then I'll help women be at peace about it, which they certainly should be. One was talking to the young on college campuses, and you know, they're sort of saying, look, I know we're messed up. We all know we're flawed, but just tell me what to do. What does a man do? I don't even know what a man does. Tell me. And the emphasis was on the doing. But what they're sort of reacting to is the earlier version of the men's movement that happened more among the boomers. You remember this, Ben.
Yes.
And, you know, it was a bit more about healing the masculine journey. It was a bit more about, you know, restoring the masculine soul and all that kind of thing. It was more therapeutic, typical of the boomers.
Yeah.
Well, I'm all for that. I absolutely believe in the restoration of the soul. But I wanted to write a book that just said, look, a man is what he does, and here's what a man does. Let's start there, and then we'll see the other side come out after the doing. So I also just kind of smack men for blaming women. Women have risen. They're getting more of the college degrees, graduate degrees these days. They're ascending more rapidly than men. Men are in a definite slump, almost a generational slump. But I tell men, listen, women have taken nothing from you that you didn't surrender in the first place. Mm-hmm. Women didn't come along and steal things from men. The feminist movement, even if I don't agree with every little jot and tittle of it, basically women wanting to be taken seriously, and it didn't take anything from any self-respecting man who was performing as he should have been in the first place. So let's stop blaming women for anything, and let's get on with being the men we're called to be. That'll be great for everybody. It'll build noble children. It'll reinforce and enable women to go even further, which we ought to celebrate every day of our lives, and it will transform society. So let's stop blaming, take our responsibilities, and get on with the doing of what a man is.
Love it. And you talk in the book really about resurrecting your inborn, timeless, essential masculine self. So you're saying this is really innate in us, and perhaps society or culture or lack of a dad or whatever environmental reason has made us different. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's exactly correct. We are different, and I let's celebrate the difference. I'm crazy about my wife, and she is definitely another creature for me.
Yeah.
And I'm glad she is. I mean, that's what I wanted. That's why I followed her around in the halls. That's why I dated her, pursued her, hunted her down, captured her caveman-like, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, the place that I see this disparity, this misunderstanding of manhood is in boys. We're almost treating boyhood like a disease these days. And men really are the ones who are responsible for this. We have to articulate what it is to be a man. We have to set a path, and we have to protect the boys. You know, I have a nephew who comes home from school. He's about 5, 6. He comes home from school, and he kind of waves at me when I'm visiting, and then he runs laps in the living room, I'm not joking, for at least 90 minutes. He just runs. And finally, 90 minutes in or so, he'll stop, fall on the couch, and say, "Hi, Uncle Stephen, how are you?" He just has got stuff working in his body that I understand very well.
And I don't,
he needs to be checked medically regularly, but we don't need to assume that he needs to be drugged to death or something because he's up like that. When my son was 13, I was the pastor of a large church in Nashville, and in walked my son with a big, huge African-American policeman friend of mine, holding him by the collar, and he winked. The African-American policeman winked at me over my son's shoulder and said, "Sir, are you this boy's father?" And I said, "Yes." Well, it turned out my son had been laying in the street to see how close a car could get to him before he'd jump up and run to the side. Now, that's an idiot thing to do, but every man listening, even though I believe me, I punished him. I took away everything he loved for about 6 months,
Yeah.
But I mean, every man listening goes, yeah, I get that.
I'd like to try that, yeah.
Sure, you want to make sure you're alive and you're a man, and yeah, you can do a John Wayne kind of thing.
That's right.
Now, of course it's stupid. Of course we're going to punish it, but that's why we need men there to say, look, this is not mental illness.
Yeah.
This is a budding man, and we're trying to drug it out, discipline it out.
Yeah.
Reality, we just need to kind of take him out in the woods and let him blow it out. That's kind of how young men are. We all know it.
Well, and what I'm hearing you say too, it's in us. Let's channel it in the right direction for some redemptive purpose, because the energy is good energy.
Yes, and I'll tell you something else. There's a very wise African village proverb that I always have really pondered and taken a lot of wisdom from. The Africans will say, if we do not initiate the boys, they will burn the village down. Hmm. Well, what does that mean? That means you got to give them a path to manhood. You got to give them some kind of I'll use the word accreditation. I don't mean academic, but some kind of a initiation, some kind of stamp, for, you know, like our Jewish friends, bar mitzvahs at the age of 13. You've got to do something to give them a path. Otherwise, they're just crazy energy and destructiveness will burn the village down. Well, that's what we're seeing happening in many places in America. But I'll tell you what, where some men get in there, and I work with a lot of NFL guys, when they get in there and work with 14 and 15-year-olds and say, hey, I'm all for you being physical, but you got to learn like a man how to temper that stuff, and then we go kill each other on the football field, that's when you see real men emerge, men who can be tough, but men who can also be temperate and have character as well.
Absolutely. You know, Stephen, the thought that keeps running through my mind as I listen to you talk, and you've even referred to this, is in our nation, and I love America, but in our nation, we've not known what to do with all this energy that's been more like a flood rather than a river. You know, it's going every direction. And so we've medicated it because that makes it easier for us as a parent or teacher. And by the way, I want to be careful. If you're medicating your son out there listening to this, I'm not saying it's all wrong, but we've over-medicated. That was our external solution to an internal challenge that we didn't know how to handle. And so the United States of America makes up 5% of the world's population, but we consume 90% of the prescription drugs given to children for ADHD and depression and so forth. I think we just decided that was easier for us to navigate our parenting journey or teaching experience rather than saying we got to channel this energy in the right direction. Am I kind of hearing you say the same thing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That energy that drives you crazy in a 13-year-old boy or an 8-year-old boy, if it's channeled the right way, you're going to have a magnificent, energetic, engaged, character-based man. Mm-hmm. It's how we handle both. If we treat boyhood as though it's offensive to society, as though it's repugnant, well, then we'll have shut down, distant, non-performing men who will be sitting around, you know, watching ESPN and resenting the women in their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
So, listen, I'm a parent of several children. My son's about as rowdy as a guy can be. I understand wanting to hit them all with, like, you know, sedative darts or something.
Yes, yeah.
I would have liked to have shot them with a dart to shoot an elephant with, you know, many times throughout our lives. But both my kids have grown up to be awesome kids. They're alive. My daughter just got back from being in the jungles of Costa Rica over spring break. I mean, they're both got my crazy adventure thing. And they understand how to manage this, what we laughingly call the Mansfield mania, which is a need to go out and get a little wild and blow things up and, you know, bark at the moon and just deal with the wildness inside of you. And that's simply a matter of teaching them and not drugging it out of them, because if we drug it, we're going to take some significant parts of them that we're going to want later in their years.
Yeah. Stephen, we are so looking forward to having you with us at a donor event later this year. It's going to be so fun. Would you mind just whetting our appetite? And I don't want to steal your thunder, but I think everybody listening would essentially say that man is right. He's right. What do I do? Are there certain things that you say right off the bat, not cliche, not predictable, but what are some things that perhaps a mother that's pulling her hair out or just a set of parents or teachers or coaches could do about this squirrely boy that really isn't, he's on his way to becoming a man one way or the other? What do we do?
Well, first of all, we recognize that a lot of what we're grappling with is God-given.
Yeah.
That this is the natural way of a young man. We don't say stop. We say rechannel.
Yeah.
We give him a band of brothers, and I would say for young women, a band of sisters, band of older sisters.
Yeah.
I'm better to speak about young men. Give them a band of brothers. You know, what I often do with young men is we go out and we play the rowdiest game we can. We just slam into each other, and then we talk about what it means to be a man, build a relationship with them. Most young men in America do not have older brother father figures.
Yeah.
They don't have anybody who's talking values. They don't have anybody whose disappointment in them would matter. If when I build a relationship with these young men, and I occasionally have to say, "Oh, I'm really disappointed that you did that," I've watched them burst into tears. Why? Because I built a relationship that registers with them and they care about. But then I also take time with them, spend money on them, occasionally put them on an airplane with me, take them to D.C. or something, and let them see a bigger world. It's really about creating a culture in which who they are is recognized and accepted, but also tempered.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when you have the combination of respect and initiation, the other things that we do, you can see some of the most troubled young men in the school take hold of something. Really, they are often your gifted ones. They're the ones who are going to really make change, but you've got to get them early and not let somebody tell them that somehow they're diseased or mentally ill. I'll say very briefly, when I was in the fifth grade, for the reasons we're discussing, my principal of the school said to my mother in my presence, "Stephen is immature and retarded."
And
when we really drill, and that's not something you should say in front of anybody. And every so often my wife will say, you know, he was right. But she's just playing. But the issue was they just didn't know how to deal with rowdy boyhood.
Yeah.
And so I just urge us all to hang in, start building the structures around these kids that can be healthy and believe that these are some of our greatest champions coming in the future.
Absolutely. I so agree with you, Stephen. And I love the fact that you're so articulate. The book, everybody, is Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, An Utterly Invigorating Guide to Being Your Most Masculine Self. Stephen Mansfield's the author. Stephen, one last question before I let you go. I know you're on to other things today. Our listeners are adults. They're teachers. There's coaches, parents. I mentioned that already. If you had just one word of advice on developing leaders among the next generation, and now really particularly boys, is there anything else you would add to what you said?
Yes. I certainly could understand the discouragement and the despair that might come upon people in those roles. My life, it was shaped almost in retrospect by teachers, coaches, and their words that I didn't even acknowledge at the time, but have lived in me forever.
Yeah.
I can remember things said in classrooms with teachers who I'm sure were glad that year, that school year was over because Mansfield was leaving the class. but my point is, I remember... I heard what they said about me. Those things have lived in me. So be encouraged. It's not the most thankful task and appreciated task at the time, but teachers have to understand that they're dealing with a kind of a generational flow, and you're pouring something into a stream that will eventually solidify in the soul of a young person. It certainly did for me. So hang in there. Use words of faith and confidence and destiny and building them up. You realize the words are building blocks and model. And don't be daunted by some of the trends of our times that seem to make what you do unimportant.
Absolutely. Well said. It's really seeing the big picture, isn't it? That this
yes.
is the season of our life. It's the preparation season, and we got to be very intentional. That's good. Awesome.
Time and again, I sit around a room in Washington, D.C., look at all these great leaders, ask them about their childhoods. They were all the bad students. They were always the ones the teachers didn't like or wanted to get rid of or were disciplined all the time. Now they're running the country. So that's the bad boys, the bad girls.
Yep.
Often they're the ones who make the reversals.
Absolutely. That's good words to heed. Stephen, thanks again for being with us today. I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you soon. And once again, great, great books. I have loved every book I've read of yours, but this next one looks fantastic. Thanks again.
Hey, I'm looking forward to our time together. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Wow, what a great episode today with Stephen and Dr. Tim. We hope you got some great points on parenting and leading this next generation from today's podcast. Now, as Tim mentioned, Stephen is going to be helping to host our donor event coming up on May 29th this year. The Growing Leaders Foundation launched last year as a way where underfunded schools and organizations could receive our Habitudes resources. So if you're an organization that's interested in using Habitudes at your school, you can go to thegrowingleadersfoundation.com and apply to receive a grant. There are different ways that we can get involved with your school or organization to help influence this next generation and get them ready for life ahead. And if you're listening to this and you're in a position to where you'd like to donate to the Grown Leaders Foundation, we would certainly appreciate that as well. You can also go to the Growing Leaders Foundation and follow the links there and make a donation, either one time or monthly donation as well. We would certainly appreciate you getting involved that way and helping to support those that are working with the next generation. So until next time, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast.